From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells. Our next guest, Damian Patton. He's the founder and CEO of Banjo. Damian has been determined to solve one of the most common but difficult problems out there, making the world's disparate data purposeful, and doing so live. Over the past 7 years, Banjo has continued to pioneer technology that reinvents what's possible in a truly connected world. Banjo is the first live-time intelligence platform that gives decision makers the ability to know information now to understand what is happening live anywhere. Damian, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me back. It's wonderful to be able to do something local in Park City.
Yeah, and the last time you were here was snowing so hard. We may have snow tonight. Who knows?
We can only hope.
We can only hope. So before we talk about new developments over at Banjo, maybe we can start at the beginning for our listeners that did not hear the first conversation we had with you back in January. Tell us and describe your company.
Yeah, so the first thing is that we're a mission-based company, not a company with a mission statement, but mission-based. And our mission is to save lives and reduce human suffering by utilizing artificial intelligence and data to make situations better. And so, you know, when you talk about data and you talk about artificial intelligence, immediately people get nervous, and they should. And part of our mandate at our company is to ensure that we're using ethics around everything we do with AI and making sure everything is moral. And we do that by stripping out all personal identifiable information from data to ensure that people's privacy is always protected no matter what. And people would think that synthesizing these billions of signals together live from all different types of data, if you didn't have the identity of people, it would be pretty useless. But it turns out that it's not. It turns out that you can find the needle in the haystack, that you can recover an abducted child, that you can help stop the opioid crisis, you can work on large social issues like homelessness without having to know who the people are, that there's just something that's going on and where to focus your attention. And that's what Banjo does. To me, it's like the greatest focusing tool on the planet that lets you know what's happening, where it's happening, but it doesn't invade on who it's happening.
And I think the distinction is that real-time is a word that is really overused and also misused. It's, as you've said before, distorted. It's not live, and you really compress time.
Yeah, so, I mean, we always hear real-time, and so we just assume that means now, live, and it doesn't anymore, right? Everyone likes to use the term real-time synonymous with that they're doing something fast. But the reality is that over time, real time is just means it's pretty historical. Even if it's 5 minutes old or 10 minutes old, the data's been stepped on. It's no longer actionable in its original format. And so for us, the innovation of being able to stream all these data signals in live, understand them the moment they're coming in, synthesize them together to find that needle in the haystack, and be able to get that out live to the people that matter most, so that you can save a life. That's the difference between live and real time is action. The difference is having information that hasn't been distorted.
So when you talk, Damian, about understanding the data that's coming at you, you know, are you triggered by keywords? How do you decipher what is real information and what is information that you're just going to let pass through and never give a second look at?
Yeah, the simple thing to say would be we were triggered by keywords, but it's so much more advanced than that. So in just a high-level overview of this is we've divided the world into little grids, and it's over a trillion of these grids, and it's about the size of the studio we're sitting in now. And we know what every grid looks like every day. We know what the weather is like there. We know if there's 911 calls there, all different types of data. And so we know what normal looks like at every square inch of this planet. So when a signal comes in, and it could be video, and it could be our system interpreting that it looks like there's a car crash in a video or that there's gunshots or whatever the case may be, our system can say that doesn't look normal for that part of the planet because it's disrupted from what normal looks like. And then our system then starts to look for other clues from thousands or tens of thousands of other signals that are around that area that are commonly not brought together. And it then verifies that, yes, that incident that you thought was not normal indeed is X, Y, or Z that's happening. And that's how we can determine that something is A, happening, that it's truthful, and that it's actionable, and then we know who to get the information to right away.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Park City local Damian Patton. He's the CEO and founder of Banjo. And when we talk about this information, and I know that our listeners are, as most anyone that you talk to about your business is probably saying, now what kind of public information? I mean, we know that there are traffic cams, weather cams, social media. What other types of sources of information do you draw from?
I mean, anything that you can imagine that's live, and like 911 phone calls, traffic sensors on the highway, applications that people are using, the telematics in their vehicles. But again, it's all anonymized, so we don't even know who it belongs to, because that's not what's important. What's important is that something is happening somewhere, not the someone. And so that's why we're able to get access to all these data, because number one, first and foremost, we have to protect privacy and we have to protect the rights of people and their civil liberties before we even focus on bringing these signals together.
And back to the tripwire in these trillions of living room size pieces, is the system sophisticated enough to know that if somebody walks through a cornfield in Kentucky in a Darth Vader outfit, then that's an unusual event, versus if that person were to walk through in a Darth Vader costume in Times Square, that would be a very normal event.
Yeah, I mean, at a high level, the system is that sophisticated, that it determines exactly that, what is normal and not normal. But again, we don't use invasive things like facial recognition, because facial recognition creates personal identifiable information, and it can prejudice against race, gender. And so we refuse to use technologies like that because we believe them to be invasive against people's civil liberties and their rights. And therefore, we stick to the things that are going to tell us what normal and not normal is, that's going to give us a clue to point in a direction of an event that's happening so we can save someone's life, whether that's getting emergency services dispatched to you faster than a 911 call if you've gotten in an auto accident, whether your child's been abducted and getting information to law enforcement faster on how to recover your child. Things that normally would take hours, maybe days in an investigation, now are reduced to seconds with this type of technology.
So for people to really understand, a perfect illustration of this is Las Vegas. Shooter knocks a window out, starts shooting down on concert goers. Some things are tripped in your tripwire. You break the story before the first 911 call is lodged. What does 5 minutes advance notice allow people to do in the way of setting up triage, getting blood, ambulances, doctors, hospitals ready, police, in the right place?
Yeah, I mean, simply it saves lives. I mean, you think about it, seconds save lives. Minutes would save many, many lives. I mean, think about it, if you're in an auto accident today, we all assume that someone else is calling 911 right away. But in reality, they're probably taking social pictures, or they're passing the incident, as you probably passed a traffic accident yesterday on the highway and thought, oh, I'm sure someone else has called 911 already. And so there's a delay. And so what this does is it compresses time so there is no delay. Well, imagine if you're in a life-threatening situation. What does 30 seconds feel like to you? What does 5 minutes feel like to you?
An eternity.
Not only is it, exactly. So it's not only your life, but it's the talking about reducing human suffering on a massive scale. And that's what this is about.
Reducing human suffering, saving human life, doing artificial intelligence for good. These are all good and hopeful things, Damian. But I'm wondering how your involvement in all of this has shaped or changed, sort of your view of human evil. You are dealing with child abductions and mass shootings, and what might you say about that?
It's hard. It's hard for our team. You know, I feel like I have the greatest team on the planet, and not just here in Utah, but all over the place now. We've expanded so much. And our team has got to look at and seize the worst of humanity every day. But the way we look at it and the way I look at it, and I talk to the team about it, is we get to be the best of humanity. We get to help encourage humanity to be better. We get to bring home an abducted child, or we get to stop a mass shooting, or we get to help solve the opioid crisis, where these people that otherwise would have, gone down a dark path or unfortunately died now are going to lead a better life. And so You could say we could become more cynical because of what we see every day, but we actually become more hopeful because we actually get to see the advantages of what our technology is doing every single day. And so it encourages us. I think from my standpoint personally, where I have a lot of pressure I put on myself is I will read about or see on the news about an abducted child. And that was unfortunately not recovered. And you look at the circumstances of how they went missing, and you look, and I know for a fact we could have saved that child had we been in that state, that jurisdiction. And so I put a lot of pressure on the team that we have to expand much faster. And so I think that's my overall look has become the pressure we put on ourselves that we can make a big difference. We're just not everywhere yet, and we're trying to be, but it's very hard to be everywhere instantaneously, as you can appreciate.
Well, we know that, in essence, Park City and Summit County has been sort of a test case for you. We know that you work a lot with our police chief, Wade Carpenter, and Sheriff Justin Martinez. And speaking of that, it sounds like you've been doing a lot of public speaking recently, and you're headed back to the International or Association of Police Chief conference next week to speak to, what, about 20,000 police chiefs?
Yeah, it's going to be a lot, and we're lucky to do it. And I think here in Park City, we're lucky to have Chief Wade Carpenter, who's going to be the incoming president in the next 4 years for the International Association of Chiefs of Police. The first time that's ever happened in the history of Utah. So it's a massive deal, and it's happening here, right here in Park City. And Sheriff Martinez and all the folks in Summit County and Park City have been very supportive of Banjo, as has the whole state of Utah. I mean, it's why tomorrow we officially open our new headquarters, and it'll be here in Utah, and it's going to be down in Salt Lake County. And that's a big deal for us, as we're not moving out of Silicon Valley, but we're putting the breadth of our company here in Utah. And it's because of how supportive the governor, the lieutenant governor, the attorney general, all have been so supportive of life-saving technology and all the different agencies and stuff. And so Utah really is the center of this technology. And so many other states, including the federal government, have taken notice of what Utah is doing in a responsible and ethical manner with data and artificial intelligence, and are now using it as a model not only for legislation in their states on how we should act responsibly with technology, but also on how we should get this technology deployed to help save lives. And so I'm grateful for Utah every day and what it's brought to us.
You've been asked to play a major role in opioid addiction in the state of Utah. Can you tell us what you all are doing? And also, I'd be curious to know, since you've gotten so involved, what have you learned that surprised you about opioid addiction?
I'll start. So the number one thing that surprised me about opioids is that no matter what you read in stats, it's not getting better. It's actually getting worse. I mean, as a homeless kid myself, I thought when I was on the streets of L.A. homeless for years, I thought it couldn't get any worse than that. But you go back to L.A. today, and the homeless crisis is way worse. Well, how can that be? How can it be, with as much technology as we have and as much money we have as a country, how can it be that our homeless crisis has gotten worse? Well, it's the same thing around opioids, except it's a problem that you didn't see every day. Homelessness you see because you see the people out on the streets. It's harder to spot those that are addicted. And so the problem was able to get exponentially worse. And so today, what we're doing is, and we're lucky we have the leadership that we do here in Salt Lake County, we were able to bring this with Mayor Jenny Wilson and her team, a new type of pilot on how to reduce the opioid crisis in a significant way. And the Department of Justice and other federal agencies who would normally not work together in this way, coupled with state agencies and county agencies and city agencies and private industry, have all come together now to try this new idea. And it's in a pilot right now, but it's so far already having really significant impact as far as people getting the help that they need, getting in open beds, finding where the open beds were, understanding where the problems in the county really are, and being able to get to them live, as opposed to everything we do in the opioid crisis. When I travel around the United States now and I talk to governors or other people in states that are majorly impacted by this, they give you a heat map and they say, well, this is where our problem is. But it's so after the fact. This is where 6 months worth of data, a year worth of data. You have to, in order to solve the problem, you have to be ahead of the problem. And so if you're always on your heels and never on your toes, how are we supposed to get ahead of the opioid crisis? Same thing with homelessness. And that's what this technology does. It lets us get ahead of it so we understand where is the problem right now, this second. Where are people that otherwise would have overdosed today that we can help, you know, and we can use our resources. I mean, one thing government has, they may be slow in a lot of things, but they have a tremendous amount of resources. And what our technology does is help them focus their resources where it matters most. so that we can save lives and we can impact. And I'm really encouraged by the leadership of Salt Lake County and what the mayor's office and the Department of Behavioral Health and everybody down there is doing around this new type of idea. And it's got such the point, even though it's only been about a month, that I can't, five, six other states' leadership have already come here to see what's going on. The federal government has come in and saying, what are you guys doing that's so radically different that it's actually starting to work so fast already? That doesn't make sense to us. But seeing is believing. I always tell people, stop talking about it. Just show people that it works. Show people the lives that are saved, because nothing convinces people more than seeing it, right? We're very visual as human beings. And that's why I always tell, like when you came to Banjo, I said, I don't want to tell you about Banjo. Just come see it yourself. When you see it work, you can't unsee it. And the same thing with the opioid crisis right now. You're taking a problem that's been invisible to most of our society and certainly making it visible.
And I would have to say that visit to your facility, the Network Operations Center, it's pretty impressive. You got a lot going on there. So the pilot's been going on for about a month, and the data so far is good.
It's beyond good. I mean, to say it's good would be a gross understatement. We didn't know it would proliferate this quickly. We didn't know that it would impact this many lives this fast. Usually things take, especially in government, years to take off. And this is, you know, 30 days, we're already seeing massive results. And because of it, we're putting a lot more resources into this. And so that's one reason you're seeing, I mean, it's one of many reasons Banjo's relocated our headquarters to Utah to be the epicenter of innovation. We are the epicenter of how all of child abduction will be handled across this country now. Mm. Utah is the one who started and honed those skills in our system that's now, you know, proliferating across the United States. Now it's with opioids, and we're doing that with school safety and child safety and other areas. So that's why we're putting so much emphasis here in Utah. And you know, we're lucky enough that we just raised a lot more money. We did so quietly. We didn't talk about it publicly. But, you know, most of that $100 million plus that we just took in that will be spent here in Utah. Since I think the last time we were on the show, I don't know, we've hired almost 100 new people
exactly.
in Utah.
Yeah.
We just announced we're going to hire another 150 here in Utah. We're expanding to other states and other offices as well. But this is where we're putting the bulk of the technology, moving everybody here.
Silicon Slopes, Point of the Mountain, where is your new base?
It's actually going to be in the Sandy, South Jordan area. We're not all the way down in Silicon Slopes. The benefit of that was we could draw from all of our folks that live in different areas of the different counties could get there more easily than being down in Silicon Slopes. And then, of course, we still have our Park City presence, and that's not going to leave because I'm here, and I won't be commuting down there every day. There'll be quite a few of us that actually are still here in Park City, and Park City will continue to grow, as will other parts of the state. But the HQ will be in the Sandy, South Jordan area.
The opioid epidemic. Help me understand what types of data you're gathering. First of all, there are so many regulations and privacy around HIPAA, right? So I'm picturing as you're talking about this chain of events where someone gets back surgery and then is on opioids and then gets addicted and then it follows. I don't know. What is the chain of information?
So it's much more simple than that. And the problem we have in this in technology and innovation and solving real problems is someone will throw out a word like HIPAA or security and everyone just freaks out and says, oh, yeah, we can't do it. Instead, let's take a step back. Let's not violate HIPAA. Let's not even consider HIPAA at all. In fact, let's even say we don't even need to know who the people that are addicted are. Why don't we just look at the, first of all, where's the ethos of the problem? Well, it's first those that are addicted that would otherwise be incarcerated today or overdose. Where are the open beds? Well, we all assume because the counties, the cities, the states, private industry all have these open beds and they say they're all full. There must be this one system that everybody knows that every open bed is full today. There's no system. It doesn't exist. There's no one who could tell you where all the open beds are today. No way, no how. And I know that sounds so simple, but in reality, because of the different silos, you have different agencies going after the same grants. You have whatever reason, you have these silos of data, and they're not able to be synthesized together. So just solving where the open bed rates were was one problem. Well, how do you do that? Well, you go and you meet the individual mission of each and every type of company or public agency. You meet their mission, whatever it may be. And by doing that, it unsilos their data. But you also want to not freak people out. And so when people mention HIPAA and they do in every meeting, you say, okay, let's take that off the table, meaning not that we're going to violate HIPAA, like let's make sure that we're not using anybody's information at all. You don't need people's information to know where naloxone stations need to be, where the majority of overdoses happening in a county, a city, in a state. Right now, live, not over a year, when people are being admitted to a hospital, you don't need to know that they're a white male, 32 years old, named John Smith. You just need to know that an individual went to this hospital, needed naloxone, so you know in that area you have a problem happening today. When kids start, you know, whether it's something happens where fentanyl starts showing up in vaping cartridges, for example, why do we want to learn about that after the fact? We should know about that live, right? That's going to become a major public health crisis if it happens. And today, with law enforcement and the data and the silo the way they are, a child could be taken to a hospital here in Park City and another child be taken to a hospital in a different county in the state, all with linked to the same problem. You think we're going to know about that the same day, the same week, that maybe even the same month? Probably not. We need to know about it live in order to help stop the influx of a new opioid crisis that could come in that form.
Well, I have a question for you that I ask a lot of guests, and that is you're a very curious person. What one question would you like to have answered that's not been answered? And you can go anywhere. You can go astrophysics. You can go paleontology. You can go the nature of consciousness. You can talk about
motorsports.
What one question has not been answered that you would like to have answered?
I've never been asked this, and I should have it off the tip of my tongue, I guess. So let me just riff on that for a second. So, you know, if I'm going to divorce myself for a minute from banjo, which is hard because I bleed banjo, so I don't really think much or do much outside of the company. The things that do frustrate me today is in our modern-day media circus that we have on all sides, right? And I'm not blaming any one group at all, but is how we haven't solved getting truthful information and stopping the disinformation that goes out there to everybody. And how the proliferation of disinformation, we call, you know, the things that are coming up now with AI, some of the negative sides of it, like with deep fakes and everything. You know, I look at that holistically from 30,000 feet and I say, this is not hard to solve, but there's also this unwillingness to want to solve. I think society kind of gets into this mode of liking this back and forth and you know, good and bad and to me, that's unfortunate. I think as a society, I'd like to see us solve some of these problems that seem impossible to solve, but they're not. And I think that until we solve things that shape us every day, which disinformation does, right? Not getting the facts, not being able to make the right decisions. The concerns that we have around artificial intelligence, like around deep fakes in the media. Why can't we solve that as a group of smart people in society? Why can't we come together and solve that? And the reality is because there's a lot of fiefdoms and a lot of silos, and why would not? But to me, those are the types of things. I mean, yeah, there are some fun things like you just mentioned, auto racing. Of course, I want to see what the next generation in auto racing. For those who don't know, I'm a huge auto racing fan and race off-road racing myself. But I don't really sit there and dwell and think about that. I wish I did. I'm sure my wife wishes I had more time to sit there and think about things non-banjo related. But every day when I wake up, I see the issues we have around our own country, around our own state, and I get fixated on solving those. And so it's hard for me to take myself out of that realm. And I don't know that I'll ever be able to.
Well, those are good questions to have answered. And when you were talking about information, when I look at your model from 30 or 40,000 feet, one of the interesting things is you get pieces of information that validate each other, that are not manipulated by each other. So that's one of the keys to you getting it right.
Yeah, it's called multi-source validation. And you know, our company has done amazing. Like I said, we have amazing people at our company, amazing engineers, but even our patent attorneys that have continued to help us protect the technology. And one of them is multi-source validation. It's a patented process that brings together live data that's never been brought together before that can validate it to ensure that something's not fake, to ensure that we're not spinning resources after something that's not exactly the way we thought it was. No, it's exact, because when something is live in this moment, it's not fake because we're watching it, we're seeing it with our own eyes. But the moment it's no longer live, has it been edited? Has it been reinterpreted? You don't mean as a human being to maybe reinterpret something, but it's a telephone game we played in school. If I tell you something, John, and you tell it to my chief of staff sitting next to you, Jesse, and it goes on and on. By the time it gets to the third or fourth person, it has a different meaning. You didn't mean to do that. It's just the way you interpreted it. And so we can't have humans interpreting over and over again over time. We have to get to we have to get to live, and then we have to validate that against other sources, because there's no one absolute truth, right?
So, Damien, I just have to ask you before we let you go, this proliferation of misinformation that permeates media, and I'll just go ahead and implicate Facebook, because there seems to be an unwillingness on the part of Mark Zuckerberg to do something real about it. Do you think, since that is a big question for you, that, you know, your multi-source validation or some application of Banjo to Facebook is in your future?
Yeah, you know, I think when you think about companies like Facebook and other large tech companies that are facing these problems, again, they're solvable problems, but what's forcing them not to solve them? And I think we have to look at the structure of capitalism and our businesses today. And I'm not saying, I'm definitely not anti-capitalism, right? I'm very pro-business, but we don't think about the social impact when we're thinking about business. We think about, if you're a Facebook, you have your investors. You're powered by the public, right? You're a publicly traded company. And so every time you make a decision, you're making it understanding, what is the impact going to be in the stock market? What's the impact going to be to investors? What shareholders' feedback are we going to get? The social impact doesn't factor in. Sure, you want to do good. I don't believe Facebook started off thinking we wanted to have all these problems. I just think the way businesses are structured today in this country, you go down a slippery slope and you can't get out of it. Once the genie's out of the bottle, you can't put it back in. And so that's another thing that we're trying to do at Banjo, is figure out how do you be altruistic from the start? How do you put social impact into capitalism, but show that you can build a massive business? It may not make the exact amount of money, as much money as a company that it is not doing that, but that's okay. It still makes a lot of money. So are we willing to give up the social impact and the good of society because we're trying to maximize the value of a dollar? And I think that's what we have to come to terms with of society. And that's hard. And that's what I think Facebook and all those others are dealing with. The genie's out of the bottle. Putting it back in is going to be impossible.
Well, you raised $100 million. I don't know if this is true or not, but I had heard that when we talk about the possible monetizing of your business, mm-hmm. that you were offered 10 times that, $1 billion, for someone that would like to have that data, maybe for stock market, mm-hmm. and those sorts of things. Are those easy decisions for you?
I mean, anyone who says anything's easy in business is probably being disingenuous. I'm a little bit of an unusual cat, and so when I say no to the kind of money you're talking about, because I'm more mission-based, I'm more mission-focused, not financial-focused, it is easier for me than it probably is the average person because of my upbringing and because of the reason I'm doing this to begin with. As a homeless kid, I have more money than I'll ever know what to do with. I mean, I sit here in Park City in my house today, and I look down, and it's a very different world than being under that underpass, that freeway. So I don't really care about money at this point. I think people who are around me know it's genuine for me. I care about solving the mission. And so it's not about maximizing dollars. I think some of our investors, they struggle with that at times, but they've also joined the mission and understand that we as a society have to figure out how to do businesses differently. Not all businesses. This doesn't mean it's all kumbaya, rainbows, and unicorns. It just means that we have to figure out another structure. So we're thinking about the social impact and the good of humanity with the decisions we make in business. And there's no encouragement to do that. The encouragement today is go raise money, whatever you got to do to raise money. You don't set out to do something negative or unethical, but it's the easiest way in our society to get money these days. So why do entrepreneurs go down that path? Because it's the only thing they're encouraged to go do. So how do we start teaching entrepreneurs to think around social impact and able to build a large business around that?
Well, it's good to get your goals aligned with the funding source, because you're all lined up, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, Damien Patton, founder and CEO of Banjo, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We love having you on.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.